Today's Taisho will be on case 14 in the Mumon Kan, the Wu Men Kwan. Case 14 is entitled Nansen Cuts the Cat in Two. Nansen Osho saw monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and said, "If you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will kill it." No one could answer, and Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, Joshu returned, and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head, and walked out. "If you had been there, you would have saved the cat," Nansen remarked. Mulong's comment. Tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put his sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason. If not, danger. Mulong's verse. Had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life. So I want to thank everybody who's able to be here. Thank you all for coming to practice Zen. And those of you who are able to be here from the beginning of the morning, I want to thank you for sitting very deeply. It was really wonderful to see everybody sitting so still and so well with such commitment. Thank you so much for that. It was really very, it was wonderful. You know, when this emergency overtook us in March, it did look at first as though we wouldn't be able to practice at all. But, you know, we have been able to create a really vigorous practice online. It's wonderful to see. As everybody here knows, we have a sitting multiple times a week in the evening, on Sunday mornings, and every other Saturday, just as we did. And this is our second online sesshin. And I have to say that, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen on that first session. And with the help of Keith and Sandy and Alex, we were able to launch it. And with a few mishaps that I hope won't happen again, it was smooth sailing most of the time. We did have one evening where Doka-san completely, I completely obliterated the Zoom meeting when I moved to Doka-san, and so the virtual Zendo disappeared for a while, but we recovered. Everybody showed up at Doka-san, and I learned the cardinal rule of Zoom, which is that you can't occupy two meetings at the same time. There's a rule of physics that two objects can't occupy the same space, and there's a rule of Zoom that says two meetings can't happen at the same time to the same person. So that's why I obliterated the Zendo. But we've learned, you know, it's been one step at a time. So it's pretty amazing that we're able to practice like this. You know, I can see everybody on the screen. Everybody's sitting really still. It's deeply exciting to me that we haven't let this interrupt our practice, you know, and it's so important. If you look at the history of Zen, you know, when we imagine the past, you know, we always like to think of, say, the Buddha's lifetime as this wonderful time where, you know, basically everybody was, interested in enlightenment and so on. But actually that wasn't the case at all. You know, in the Buddha's own lifetime, his own people, his own clan was wiped out in a massacre. You could call it a genocide if you want. The Buddha had to work very hard to preserve the Sangha. And Japanese and Chinese history, there were many moments. In China, there were many emperors who tried to wipe Buddhism out. I mean, people were afraid of Buddhism because it, in some ways, undercut the values of the society. You know, Buddhism said, look, you know, the most important thing isn't to make China a powerful empire. The most important thing is for people to wake up and be compassionate beings. And not everybody liked that idea. In our culture, you know, it's quite similar. You know, basically our culture is really mostly about, if I may say so, about money and power. And so, you know, pursuing something like this makes you a bit of an oddball. It makes you an odd duck, you know. And yet, you know, everybody here has had the courage to push back against the values of their society and present themselves here and practice deeply and wholeheartedly, even though, you know, we won't make a dime off of this, right? And nobody will remember our names, right? And it doesn't matter, because names don't matter. And what matters is waking up. And so, you know, in China too, that was the value taught by the Sangha, and many people found that threatening, right? You know, Zen has had a lot of ups and downs, Buddhism has had a lot of ups and downs, and yet people have been able to be creative again and again. And that's why I think Buddhism is so alive. So anyway, thank you for doing such a wonderful job this morning. And this is a very famous koan. If you've read any books on Zen, you've probably read about this. But the koan basically has this backstory. In the Vinaya, Pratimokkha rules, the ancient rules for monks and nuns, it's not allowed for monks and nuns to keep a pet, right? It's not permitted. Nevertheless, in Nonsense Monastery, somehow a cat had wandered into the monastery, and the monks fell in love with the cat, which is not hard to understand if you have cats, as I do. I love cats, and I love my cat, Henry, so much. And so, Henry walked into my house one day and sat in a chair, and that was his chair forever, right? So this cat came into the temple, and the monks fell in love with it, and they said, okay, we'll suspend the rules in this case, and they adopted the cat. But, the temple really had two wings. You know, there was a east wing and a west wing. And the cat would go over to the east wing and stay with the monks there. And the monks would be giving the kitty special food. Maybe they would, monks and nuns are not allowed to eat meat, but maybe they would give the cat some rice and milk or something like that. And the cat would stay over there. And then on the other wing of the temple, people would say, well, why isn't the kitty coming over here? Then they would go and try to lure the cat over to the other wing. And pretty soon, there was like a little war going on between the east and west wing monks over the cat. People finally were, friendships were dissolving. And instead of concentrating on their practice, people were coming into the Zendo thinking, I hope we've hidden the cat well, and those bastards from the west wing aren't going to come over and kidnap it while we're sitting. And so it was really causing a deterioration in the spirit of practice at the temple. So Nansen decided that it was a kind of emergency on many levels. It's not just that people weren't getting along, but that people were losing sight of many of what Zen practice is all about, right? And so one day he came into the Zendo and he had the cat. And he held the cat up and he said, if one person in this room can say a word of Zen, can express Buddha nature or enlightened awareness. If one person can express enlightened awareness, I will spare the life of this cat. But if nobody can do that, I will cut the cat in two. And the monks sat there and nobody could express one word of enlightened awareness. And Nansen cut the cat in two, which is a much bigger violation of the rules than owning a cat. Killing anything is a violation of the precepts, the basic rules of Buddhism. And so then Nansen went back to his room and probably cried. Anyway, later, Nansen's student, his most advanced student, Joshu, Zhao Zhou, showed up. When Joshu heard about it, he walked into Nansen's room and took off his sandal, put it on his head, and then walked back out. And Nanchuan said, "Oh man," you know, I can see him saying this with tears in his eyes, and, "Oh man, if only you had been here, you could have saved the cat." So that's the story, right? That's the story. Now, please understand that none of the koans in the Momonkan are historical documents, okay? So even though Zen students treat koans as though they were historical documents, they aren't. So there was no tape recorder going when Joshu went into Nansen's room and put his shoe on his head and walked out. There are many conversations that happen in koans, and there would have been no witnesses, and in fact, nobody wrote it down. So you have to understand that the koans are really, to some degree, fictional stories. Okay, they were written by Zen masters like Wu Men, to help people wake up. And they express, they're based upon legend or popular culture, or they're based upon stories passed down through Zen tradition. But please, under no circumstances should you ever kill a cat, okay? Or if you can help it, don't kill or cause to be killed any living thing. But the fact that in the story, Nansen does this, it is very important, you know, because so much is at stake in his action. So much is at stake in, how shall I put it? You know, the most sacred thing for Buddhism is compassion, right? For all sentient beings. And compassion arises when the separation between myself and everything else disappears. That's, for Buddhism, that's the essence, right, is compassion for all sentient beings. Right? So this is like a really grave action, and we should be troubled by it, you know. It's very important to have what you could call reverence for life. You know, the more we practice Zen, the more we are going to experience a kind of deep reverence for life, the sacredness of life, right? The absolute value of life. People ordinarily don't have powerful identification with anything around them, even their own spouses and children, right? A lot of time people are very cut off from the world around them. But you know, if you practice Zen, one of the things that happens is that very gradually the shell around yourself that you created to protect yourself begins to dissolve. And the more you practice Zen, you have these moments where a person or a bird or a cat or even blades of grass or trees that you have always looked at as out there, you suddenly realize are your true self, as we say in Zen. You know, this very powerful identification with the world around you. And when this happens, right, when this happens, there's this onrush of, you could say, like love or compassion. And this is, the more you sit, the more often these experiences happen. And it's like gradually the wall you've constructed around yourself is worn away or dissolved, and the self yourself becomes kind of porous, you could say. And then eventually you're experiencing other people and other things as yourself. And as I say, this is accompanied by like this very powerful experience of compassion. So, the problem is that that state of being is difficult for all human beings to achieve much of the time. Sometimes we spontaneously achieve that state. You know, so one of the ways we experience that state is in romantic love. You know, so when we're at a certain age, you know, we might fall in love and we meet somebody, and, you know, we experience this powerful sense of identification. And then, you know, for a while, it's almost, if you've been in love, if you've had this experience, it can be like heaven, right? It's like, you know, people will say to the person they've fallen in love with, I feel like I can be totally open with you. You know, I feel like I have no secrets from you. It's like I'm an open book to you, right? And the other person, you know, will often say, you know, I feel the same way. I feel like we were born to be together. I feel, you know, I feel completed by your presence. I feel like you are me, and so on. And this is not an illusion. You know, this is not an illusion. From the Buddhist standpoint, this is a glimpse into fundamental reality. Right? But, you know, but then what often happens is, and this is the tragic dimension, right? This is the tragic dimension. You know, that state of porousness, you could say, doesn't always persist, right? You know, one day, you know, you're coming down the stairs and suddenly the person you thought was your best friend in the world says something to you that's slighting and hurtful. Right? And they might say, you know, I never realized you're putting on a lot of weight, right? You know, maybe you've been in a stressful situation and so, you know, you're really putting on a lot of weight. It's not a good look for you. It's like, oh, ouch, right? And it hurts, right? Somebody that it might not be a loving comment. It might be a loving comment, and it might not be a loving comment. You don't know how to read it, right? It's like, how do I read that? You know, is that meant to hurt me? And you know, I myself have said things to people I love that hurt them. And I have to confess that when I haven't been at my best, I have sometimes said things to people that I love in order to hurt them, and vice versa, right? That humans do that, you know? And so, you know, what eventually happens is that, you know, that beautiful openness that we experience can begin to close up, right? Can begin to close up. And then, you know, that kind of unconditional trust begins to disappear, you know, and that it can disappear a little bit, and it can disappear completely, And it can disappear, or it can disappear some of the time. And sometimes people are able to sort of achieve a kind of like deeper insight, right? Deeper insight. So, you know, it's possible to say, even though this person has hurt me, I'm going to continue to try to be open to this person. And I'm going to try to understand the person better in order to maintain a kind of openness in our relationship. And you know, we all realize, you know, sometimes if we're not too self-centered, we realize that the reason our partner might have said something to hurt us is that they're frightened or fearful or injured. And we've all said things to people that injured them that we didn't mean to hurt their feelings, but it did, you know. So there's a way of working through the situation sometimes, and sometimes there's not. You know, sometimes people go from this state of really like a paradise of openness to like warfare, right? It's very sad and unpleasant. And in a way, you could say that that's what happened in the temple, right? You know, you could imagine all the monks coming to the temple, you know, all of them decided to follow the Great Way. All of them took vows, you know, let me put my small self aside and wake up fully and help others wake up. You know, day one in the monastery, you're walking around thinking, you know, all of these people have a noble intention. You know, what wonderful people. But they're human beings, right? I'll never forget, for about 6 years, I used to train with a man named Edo Shimano in New York State. After I finished my training with Webb and Genki Roshi, Genki Takabayashi, I came to New Jersey because of my job, and even though I finished my training with Genki and Webb, I started training with Shimano Roshi. And I was staying at his monastery, walking around this beautiful lake in his monastery. And the place is absolutely gorgeous. It's a beautiful traditional, outside it looks like a traditional Japanese temple. And it's on this beautiful lake, Beecher Lake. And I was walking, I got there early because it's so beautiful. I wanted to spend a few days just grooving on the nature. And I was walking around the lake, and there was a guy on the other side of the lake from the temple. And he introduced himself, and he said, you know, I'm a resident here. I came here from Belgium to practice Zen. And I said, oh, that's fantastic. You know, how wonderful. How's it going? And he said, terrible. He said, everybody argues all the time. You know, everybody argues all the time. And, you know, I think he had had in mind this idea that everybody at the temple was going to be a bodhisattva. But please realize that at bodhisattvas are sometimes resident at temples and sometimes not. Most of the people at temples want to be bodhisattvas, but they're not there yet. So, you know, maybe you're a monk in nonsense temple. And you've taken vows, and you've gone there, and you're going to practice. And day one, you're thinking, "Oh, I love these people. They all want to wake up. You know, everything they do is wonderful." You know, and then one day, you know, the cat comes into the temple, and you know, then there's this fight over the cat. And we've all had something like that in our lives, right? And now this loving relationship begins to deteriorate, right? Maybe the East Wing monks lure the cat over with rice and milk, and then, you know, maybe one of the monks wants to sleep with the cat. The cat climbs on the monk's mat when he's going to sleep, and then the monks on the other wing say, "What? He slept with the cat, but he bribed the cat. Don't you see? He gave him milk and rice. They really like us more. The cat really likes us more. You know, if we had a fair fight, you know, this would be a fair competition. So, you know, this happens to all of us, you know. We gradually lose this openness, this kind of trust in our circumstances. And it becomes very hard for us to restore that openness and that trust, right? I couldn't stay up all night because I had to get ready for Sesshin, but I took a break and I was watching some of the Democratic National Convention. And I thought it was so interesting because, you know, we're as a society in a situation where we have lost a lot of faith in each other and in our way of life and in our political system and, you know, just in general, in human nature, you know. We have this terrible leader, right? This terrible, terrible person running the country, and, you know, sort of like a gang of, I have to say it, like a gang of thugs running the country. It's frightening to see that, but it has the effect of undermining people's confidence in everything, in everyone. And on top of it, we have a pandemic, right? So, you know, we're in a uniquely difficult situation. And, you know, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about the Democratic National Convention was that they had, in a way, just thrown out the window most of what happens at a political convention, you know? So, you know, you couldn't have these big crowds and these, I don't know if you've ever heard this word, but they're called stem winders. They're long political speeches that go on and on. They're called stem winders because in the old days, people used to have to wind their watch as the spring was running out of energy. Now there's a battery in your watch. But the idea is that political speeches would go on so long, your watch would run out of energy and you'd have to wind it back up. And, you know, if you have ever seen political conventions in the past, you know, there are these very stereotyped speeches and these long, empty expressions of loyalty or excitement or, you know, whatever. And the whole thing, in my opinion, has been a dead spectacle for a long time. And they're often very stage managed so that, you know, these very false emotions are presented in public. And I thought, last night, you know, they sort of started again. They had to because of the COVID emergency. You know, they had to reinvent this convention. And I thought that there was a kind of genuineness and vulnerability that happened. You know, it's like they had to reinvent this. And when they did, I think what they have is better than it's ever been. I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but I was very moved. I thought it was really different from political conventions I've grown up with and I've seen in my life. And there was a kind of genuineness, people just talking into a Zoom camera, right? About their problems and about their fears and so on. And that genuineness was wonderful. And it's like, some of the best things about human beings come out at those moments when we don't know where we're going or what we're doing, and we have to just start again, right? And I think that's the secret to getting out of this situation where there's a kind of downward spiral where our trust in each other, that openness is disappearing. And you know, how do we get out of that downward spiral? How do we get out of, you know, we want to live in a world where we're open and loving and connected, but things happen to us and then we get into that downward spiral. And I thought the convention last night was really unusual because somebody had the courage to just say, let's get rid of all the hats we throw in the air and the banners and the rah-rah, and let's just talk to people. And there was a kind of awkwardness about it too, right? There was a kind of amateurish quality to it too. It wasn't always highly choreographed. It wasn't always totally polished. And I feel that probably they weren't sure when it went on air if it was going to be a big flop or if it was going to be a success. But they were willing, I think, to go back to zero, willing to go back to zero. And I think that's the key to many things, and it's a central aspect of Zen practice. You know, when we do Zen, we learn how to sit down on the cushion and we practice breath meditation until we experience wu xin. And when we enter wu xin, it's like going back to zero. You know, if you're in wu xin, it's like unlearning or letting go of absolutely everything. And in my opinion, this ability, our ability to do this is like our saving grace, right? Because, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, our default position is enlightenment. You know, fundamentally, humans are Buddhas. But, you know, we don't live in a culture that is enlightened. And the people around us aren't always at their best, aren't always enlightened. And so, you know, the world we live in is not an enlightened world in itself. And we can get trapped by this, you know, the blow for blow aspect of our world, of our human society. And we can lose sight of our intrinsic Buddha nature. But, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we watch the breath and we begin to enter deep wu xin, you know, I can't praise that experience highly enough. You know, it's like a radical deconditioning, radical stepping away from everything. And in that state, it's possible, first of all, if you stay in wu xin long enough, it's deeply purifying. You know, so if you are frustrated and angry and fearful, and you don't know where to turn, you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and eventually your mind begins to go blank. And then you'll notice that after a few hours of sitting like that, your anxiety level goes down, and the defense mechanisms that you've constructed around yourself begin to unlock, right? It's like, you know, you begin to feel released. And you know, this process of like liberating ourselves through encountering emptiness can be deepened and deepened and deepened. And as we're doing that, we're like undoing all the karma, all the habits, the reactive habits that we've acquired in our lives, often in response to painful situations or injuries. And as these begin to unlock, you know, we begin to feel more open. And in that state, you know, it's possible all of a sudden, you know, to look at the world like with fresh eyes, with like Buddha eyes, you know. You know, because we get injured, it becomes harder and harder to see things through the eyes of, say, compassion, because we ourselves feel injured and endangered. But when we go into deep wu xin and stay there for a while, it's incredibly nourishing and liberating, right? And, you know, we can let go of the things that have hurt us. And even more powerfully, we can let go of the injuries we have done to others, you know, which are at least as heavy a weight that we carry around as the injuries that have been done to us. So, you know, the early stages of Sesshin, the early days of Sesshin, are like purifying body, mind, and heart. Body, mind, and heart. You know, by entering deeply into Mushin. And it's like all the negative karma that holds us in chains, so to speak, begins to drop away. And we begin to have moments where we are looking at the world around us with like illuminated eyes, right? Like illuminated eyes. It's like suddenly we rediscover the Buddha inside us. And when we look at the world, we see the Buddha out there too, you know. So this is what Sesshin is all about, going deeply into that emptiness and gradually liberating ourselves from these mental habits and seeing things with fresh eyes. And this is what koan training is all about. And it's what nonsense monks were unable to do at that moment because they'd forgotten about Wuxin. They'd forgotten about Mushin. So, you know, he walked into the Zendo and he asked them the simplest, you know, he came into the Zendo with a cat and a sword. And he said, if one person here can say one word that's enlightened, I will spare the cat. You know, somebody should have just said, I love that little kitty. And Nansen would have given him a big kiss on the head, right? Oh, good for you, you know. But people were paralyzed by their greed, anger, and delusion, you could say. And they couldn't respond. And when he cut the cat in two, you know, I imagine that it was so shocking that their minds went totally blank. And he reminded them, first of all, of what's at stake if we fall away from our enlightened nature. Destruction. But he also reminded them of the door to their enlightened nature. Mushin. You know, their minds went blank. So when Joshu returns, you know, he's practiced Mushin for 30 years, right? He lives in that openness. And he has made mistakes like everybody else. He's injured and has been injured like everybody else. But, you know, he knows how to untie his chains. So, you know, he's living deeply in that openness. And he comes back and Nonsense tells him what happened. And Xiaozhou, when you can go into that emptiness, you can see the world with fresh eyes, right? You're no longer bound by the expectations of others or by what's happened in the past, right? You act spontaneously from a place of compassion. So, you know, Joshu doesn't even have to think about it. He just puts his shoe on his head and walks out the door backward. In other words, I don't care if I look like a fool. I'm going to express loving kindness in any way available to me at this moment. And that's what he does. And Joshu says, ah, if you had been here, I would have spared the cat. A monk could have said, don't kill it. Joshua wouldn't have killed it. Any expression of connection would have saved the cat. So, you know, we all have moments when we aren't able to free ourselves from our obstacles, but this is the path. We've come here to practice this path of purifying body, mind, and heart. It's like one link at a time. We're liberating ourselves from our karmic chains. And, you know, rediscovering the our intrinsic Buddha nature, rediscovering the Buddha inside of us. So it's always an emergency, actually. You know, when he killed the cat, it was an emergency. But, you know, we're in an emergency right now. Maybe two or three emergencies. Two or three emergencies at once. And so it's really wonderful that all of you have chosen to respond to these multiple crises by coming here and practicing in this on this beautiful path. Nansen Osho means priest, monk. Nansen Osho saw monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and he said, "If you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will kill it." No one could answer, and Nansen cut the cat in two. Wuxin. That evening, Joshu returned, and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head, and walked out. "If you had been there, you would have saved the cat." Mumon's comment, "Tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put his sandal on his head?" If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason, if not danger. Mumon's verse, "Had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life."